Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show former SpaceX engineer and founder of Levels, Josh Clemente. Now, in this second conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from the American obesity crisis, burnout in healthcare providers, the ripple effect of the pandemic, how AI is bringing exciting technology to the world of healthcare, finding autonomy in your own health journey through Levels, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Josh Clemente. Enjoy. Well, Josh, I want to start by saying welcome back to the Behind the Shield podcast. You are my guest on episode 381, which I looked up. It looked like it was towards the end of 2020. So very different time when we were sitting down last time, I'm sure. So firstly, I just want to welcome you back onto the show.
Well, thanks a ton, James. It's really awesome to be back on and looking forward to the conversation.
So as an icebreaker, and I love revisiting COVID or the pandemic for the simple reason that no matter what people's kind of perspective was at that time, it's pretty, you know, glaring that at the end of it, everyone was like, well, I don't want to talk about it anymore. And I think that's such a tragedy because there were so many lessons that we needed to learn from it. So firstly, just through your personal perspective, talk to me about, you know, going through that and then emerging on the other side.
You know, there's some sort of like social amnesia that seems to have kicked in where it's almost hard for me to remember that time period, to be honest. And it was obviously tremendously difficult. The things that changed my life, I moved cross country just prior to the COVID pandemic. And I had just started Levels in 2019, late 2019. And so we were only a few months into this giant initiative. And so the first, you know, I guess three, four, depending on how long you think the pandemic went, the first few years of this was in the context of COVID, and it changed everything about business dynamics, the shift to remote work, which, you know, I don't naturally fit, I think, psychologically into a remote environment. It can be, I'll just say, I remember a huge sense of loneliness and kind of this sense that each day, despite feeling like I was working while my laptop was open, I would close it and I would look around and it would kind of be like I was just in virtual reality. And that's what life felt like. It felt like we were all in a virtual reality trying to emulate life, but actually it wasn't really happening. And I think that's why the time dilation happened. And it's hard to remember those years because everything was so the same. We were all, I don't know, hiding away, and or a lot of people were, and very difficult to have a life, especially in the Philadelphia area, which was quite aggressive about the protocols. I got married during that time period, which, you know, in retrospect, we were able to get a wedding in between these two spikes where we were allowed to have a pretty normal gathering without, you know, there weren't really limitations on the number of guests. And so we got very lucky, in the timing, but I just think about that there were many people who didn't join because they didn't want to be a part of that gathering because they were concerned. And so there's just a lot of loss and a lot of things that, although I'm very happy that I got to experience those things, certainly life was different in ways that I don't even think I can quantify. You know, how do you quantify what was different about life when you can only live the experience that you had? And you know, a lot of time away from family, unfortunately, because we were all spread out and traveling was difficult. And I think that was probably the worst part of all.
Well, I've said this, you know, even right in the middle of it, the biggest tragedy to me is if you really wrote down on a piece of paper, how could you make people more likely to get COVID or have a bad experience? It's exactly what happened. Okay, so I want you to stay in your house. I don't want you to see any of your friends and family. Don't exercise. Get fast food delivered to your house and binge watch Tiger King. It's pretty much, you know, if you want to make people vulnerable, it's what we did. So it's important that we then reflect and go, what was done well, what was done poorly? The demonizing, you know, flat demonizing of the vaccine, also poorly, because I've had people in ICUs that said, yeah, the vaccinated patients had a much better outcome usually. Now, these are people with pre-existing conditions, so that's a whole conversation in itself. But, you know, it was this kind of, you know, World War One trench mentality rather than stand in the middle and then what can we take away? Mm-hmm. So through your eyes, you know, what are the takeaways that we should be reflecting on now as we stand here in 2025?
I love your perspective there, being nuanced about it, because there is a lot of nuance. I think the difficult thing for me was that, and this is actually a problem that I have with the healthcare system, generally speaking, is that we use a public health lens to make specific individual recommendations. What I mean by that is that we look at the whole population and we do a bunch of statistics and math on it. And we say, you know, given the highest probability of transmission, which often, in this case, very often, was in people who had pre-existing conditions and comorbidities, given their likelihood of a high-risk infection, we need to address everyone as though they are that person. And we need to enforce protocols as though everyone is that person. And it's this like lowest common denominator thinking. And I don't mean that to say that the people who have pre-existing conditions don't matter. It's that we were compromising by telling everyone to act as though they had pre-existing conditions. We were compromising everyone who was not in that situation, because we were effectively putting people on bed rest. You know, if you look at the studies on there are some fascinating studies. There was one, I think it was in Sweden, and they took a rowing team, young collegiate athletes who were at their peak, and put them on forced bed rest for, I think it was only 1 to 2 weeks. And they followed the subset of that group who were on bed rest versus those that kept their normal routines, had for the rest of their lives diminished health. And so they had a higher predisposition for long-term health disorders, including diabetes, heart disease, et cetera. And this has been seen for women who are pregnant, who have to go on bed rest, who have, you know, high risk pregnancy. We see the same thing. Long term, their health outcomes are completely affected. And the point there is we were essentially doing something like that to very healthy people, which caused a reduction in your immune response. It caused like the reduction in emotional health and social health. And we were doing that as though, because we took a public health lens and treated, we tried to like cram everyone into a single box and say, how should the highest risk person respond? And I think that is a huge failure. And when I extrapolate that out to how we treat healthcare generally, we use public health methodology, lowest common denominator methodology all the time. And we give one size fits all recommendations that do not help the individual decide what I should do given my own personal health state today, who I actually am, not who the average general person out there is. And we've got to get much more nuanced about these things. And that's kind of like what I care most about. There was plenty of research, plenty of evidence at the time when COVID was roaring that people with metabolic conditions and the elderly were the ones who were most at risk. And the mandate for everyone else should have been improve your metabolic health, improve your immune response, improve your strength, add muscle, be resilient. That's what you should be doing right now, not hiding in your room in the dark, eating fast food.
Absolutely. I think that was what was a huge disservice when we reflect back now, is that there were so many of us that would have been more than happy to go out there and keep the world moving and allow the ones that are vulnerable to shelter in place, you know, and even our children. We realized it was actually not really detrimental to the children unless, again, there's something pre-existing that's going to affect the immune system. And absolutely, let's keep them, you know, somewhere safe as well. But you know, let the kids go back to school, let the people who, you know, are keeping the country running, keep the country running. Yeah. But instead we saw these vaccine mandates and terminations and, you know, of fit first responders. So, yeah, it was such a disservice. And I think one of the the things. I've talked about this. There was a really horrendous incident in my son's middle school. My son was the victim of it. And it just destroyed trust in, because it was multiple kids it was exposed to, in these children saying, I'm struggling. They just didn't even want to put their hand up anymore because of what was happening. It was just basically a 72-hour psych hold of any of these kids that were saying, hey, I need some help. Not I'm going to shoot up the school, and not I'm going to take my own life, just I'm struggling. I feel the same as we come out of COVID. And I think it was kind of the response to the murder of the United Healthcare CEO really showed that underlying feeling of distrust. And I feel that the kind of cracks are showing now. So I think, you know, what you're talking about really is so pertinent, especially when you think 70% of the country is obese or overweight, over 40% is obese. If you're taking that median now, what does that mean if you're, you know, an active, you know, athletic man or woman? Like, your healthcare is now being projected by 70% sickness. So you're absolutely right. If you're taking median statistics, it's completely skewed from where we actually need to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, we don't have, I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of modern healthcare is that we do not have any aspirational or optimistic view. It's all about preservation of a ticking heart in the face of inevitable disease. It's really like, let's wait and watch and look for symptoms, and eventually you'll get them, and then we'll eventually put you on some sort of last line defense. And what we should have done in the pandemic is a microcosm of what we have to do in regular life, which is to say, here's where you are, here is what optimal looks like, and here is how you get to optimal. And that is not going to be an injection, it's not going to be a pill. In most cases, it's going to be a lot of small behaviors that compound over long time periods that everyone is held accountable to at the individual level. Because your doctor can't keep you safe. You are the one, each of us individually should feel like we are responsible for maintaining our health. You know, I controversially say, doctors should not be treating chronic illness. Right now, 93% of American adults have at least one symptom of metabolic disorder. Now, that doesn't mean that they have some sort of disease just yet, but they are clearly trending in that direction. And that burden on the healthcare system is destroying the system. It cannot sustain it. And so doctors need to stop. They need to reflect back to individuals. Here is where you are. These are the actions you're taking each day that affect your health status. And here's how you can improve them. Here are the tools that you need. You know, and we need an industry to step up and provide those tools. But at the end of the day, it's the individual's responsibility to know their health state, to know the factors involved, and to take action. And I think we just completely abstract that away for some reason. We don't want people to feel a sense of responsibility, or I'm not exactly sure all the incentives. There's a bunch. But at the end of the day, it's very rare for people to feel like they are actually in control and empowered over their health. It seems like chronic disease just happens to you. There's nothing you can do about it. And when that does, get your doctor to give you the right prescriptions. And COVID was unfortunately an accelerated microcosm of that exact dynamic.
What impact do you think the prescription drug television commercials has on this? Because we're one of only two countries in the world, us and New Zealand, that even allow advertising for pharmaceuticals on television.
That is such a deep question, and one that I would absolutely love to have a control to look at, because my instinct, so I've gone through phases in terms of how I think about advertising. There was a time in my life when I thought, advertising doesn't work. You know, I tune out any sort of advertisement. When I see billboards, it just makes me mad. I don't have any desire to go purchase that thing. It's just like, it's out there. It's garish. It's ugly. It's annoying. I want to fast forward through them. How can this possibly be actually converting people into customers? As I've gotten deeper into business, and I've started to better understand the pervasive, repetitive messaging and the effect that it has on people's behavior, it is obvious that we are all a product in and of itself of the advertising system. What we buy, how we run our lives, it is a downstream consequence of what we're told matters and what our friends purchase and what we see. And whether it's you or somebody in your circle who is prone to advertising, it eventually makes it into your home, bottom line. And there's no possible way that pharmaceutical advertising is not mass affecting the psychology of healthcare. when you are watching TV, even if it's in the background subconsciously, when you're hearing that, you know, chronic illness, symptom X, Y, or Z is addressed by this pill, it starts to reinforce in your mind that disease happens to people and pills are the solution. And I think if nothing else, that is a cycle that we need to break, because it's fundamentally not true. Almost all, and I'm specifically talking about chronic illness over and over again, because again, the vast majority of the population, 9 of the 10 causes, leading causes of death in the United States are directly chronic illnesses or are accelerated or caused by chronic illnesses. And that's stroke, it's heart disease, it's Alzheimer's disease, and dementia, it's diabetes. These are the things that are killing people every year. Infections like, chronic pulmonary diseases of the lungs, all of these are accelerated by chronic illness. So the things that are killing people, right, and the things that are causing 9 out of every $10 of spend in the healthcare system are these chronic illnesses. And so the vast majority of products being developed and that are being advertised to us are addressing these. And it's creating this imprint in our minds as a society that's the dynamic. You get it, you take a pill. And I think that's broken. And if for no other reason, we should at least run the experiment. What happens if we turn off the advertising? What happens if we just do it like every other country except for New Zealand and just run it for 5 years? Do people start to feel, do we replace those with an empowerment message where exercise and nutrition and sleep and stress management and emotional relationships, if we talk about those things in that same slot on primetime news, does it start to shift and move the needle? I don't know. I think it's worthwhile.
Absolutely. We can change the news while we're at it too. Speaking of repetitive programming.
No doubt. No doubt.
All right. Well, then let's just kind of circle around for a second again. I think it's worth revisiting. Talk to me about the industry that you came from. What made you make the jump, and you know, where the AI and the kind of original platform that you developed back in 2019, and then we'll start walking through to where you are today.
Yeah. So my background is aerospace engineering. I was never into biology or healthcare, really. It actually happened, the way that this all came about was through a really interesting life experience. So I was working at SpaceX. I was relatively early there. I started in 2010, which is a long time ago now. But I had a very, very awesome experience there. I was fresh out of college and just loving this insanely intense, competitive, and fast-moving environment that we had at SpaceX. And about halfway through my time there, I was kind of picked as one of the first employees to work on our astronaut flight program. So originally SpaceX was just a rocket provider. We would launch payload satellites into space for other companies. And then we won a contract to launch astronauts into space after the space shuttle was retired. And so we needed to build now a capsule that could carry human beings, you know, alive and well into orbit. That I was one of the first four on that program. And that was an insanely awesome opportunity because it connected me with what I think is now pretty clearly an example of how broken our health technology is. And so I'll try to, you know, tell this in brief, but when I was there, my job was to develop the oxygen breathing systems and the fire suppression systems actually for the space capsule. So if a fire breaks out inside of this very enclosed space, we needed to put that out. We need to quickly identify it, put it out. And we also needed to maintain inside of this small volume, it's about the size of a small car, a livable, breathable, safe, non-toxic atmosphere so people could be breathing it, right? And so all the systems associated with that were on my plate. And I found myself wondering, you know, how do I know if we have 7 different people in this spacecraft and they're all, let's say you have a 95th percentile male and a 5th percentile, I'm exaggerating here, let's say 50th percentile female in terms of body size in this capsule, they have totally different metabolic requirements. They're breathing at different rates. They have different body mass. They have different, circulatory systems. How do I know that all of these people are healthy? Like what sort of data can we acquire from these people that we could measure and then know as the people operating the spacecraft that they're all healthy? And I got met with blank stares when I would ask this question. I was totally naive. I didn't know. I thought there surely was some advanced technology where you could put a little patch on and it would be continuously monitoring, you know, health for this, for, you know, for a human being. It turns out that does not exist. And I didn't, you know, this is, again, I was learning this in real time. I thought that was interesting because as the engineer developing these systems, I had sensors on top of sensors on every single functional component of the system I was designing. I had hundreds of data channels that all combined to tell me, is my system functional? Is that system feeding into another system that's functional? And is the spacecraft overall performing in a healthy way? And that's just the water you live in as a systems engineer. You are measuring all the time the health state of whatever machine you're building. And so when I found out that not only did I have to keep these astronauts healthy without having any way of measuring what that even means, but that the industry outside of, you know, this incredibly advanced astronaut program was clearly suffering from the same problem. We did not have the ability to measure human health. That was a mind-blowing realization. And so that was part one. And then part two was five, six years into SpaceX, I was just totally burning out. I was physically fit. I've always been fairly fit. I was a CrossFit trainer at the time. So, you know, working my job and then I'd go teach CrossFit classes and, work really hard in the gym. And I kind of thought physical fitness was equivalent to health in most cases. And I started to get surprised by how terrible I felt every day. You know, I would have these episodes of just like shakiness and cold sweat and like a pit in my stomach and just extreme fatigue. And it got bad enough that I actually called my mom and was like, I think you're the first person I'm telling this, but I think I have a chronic illness, like a terminal illness potentially. Like there's something so bad happening that I don't even know how to describe it. It feels like a systemic shutdown. And she said, you need to get to a doctor and work with them to find out. I went to the doctor. The doctor ran a blood panel. He said, you're young, you're healthy, you're fit. Get out of my office. You're totally fine. That was unsatisfactory. And so I realized these two pieces of the puzzle came together where I suddenly had this moment of what I'm experiencing at work where I can't measure human health is actually affecting me. I don't know my own health state. This is like such a huge problem. I'm trying to figure out, am I dying of a disease? Like, and I can't even answer that question confidently, other than getting sort of shooed out of a doctor's office. And to accelerate the story, I started reading just voraciously about health technology and trying to figure out, like, was anyone working on this problem? And I stumbled across a device called a continuous glucose monitor, which is mentioned in a book by Rob Wolf, who's kind of a paleo CrossFit guy. And this technology felt like an incredible breakthrough. It's a little device you can wear on your body that is continuously measuring blood sugar, which is one of the major energy molecules in the human body, and is so closely associated with health state. And I thought, okay, amazing. And it streams those data directly to your phone. And I thought, all right, amazing. This is the step towards the technology I was thinking we had already. And so I tried to get one. My doctor returned me down. And long story short, that kicked off a personal like sort of crusade to say, I deserve access to this technology. When I did get it, it was life-changing. And now with Levels, I left SpaceX and decided I'm going to make the technology to help us understand our health available and actionable for as many people as possible.
It's so funny that you had that kind of observation because the people listening, most people in police, fire, EMS, corrections, dispatch, etc., there's so much money poured into the technology around us and so little investment in the human being. But without the human being, a fire engine isn't going to move. You know, 911 call is not going to be answered, but it's that complete disconnect. So, you know, people think that we work in the same realm as, you know, the tier one special operators and, you know, these elite performers on the planet, because we really are asked at the drop of a hat in our worst calls to perform at an incredibly high level, mentally, physically, emotionally. But when I speak to, for example, the Delta and the SEAL Team 6 guys, you know, they have the psychologists and the physiologists and the, you know, all the people, they have this amazing group around to forge performance. When it comes to first responders, the conversation, as you, I'm sure, have come across now is really, well, we keep dying. Can you get us to die a little bit less? It's not even close to performance. It should be. There's this massive gap, and I hope we're beginning to kind of lead the charge in fixing the work, which will then, you know, put the performance conversation front and center. But people have this assumption that, yeah, we're all taken care of, and, you know, we're all in this great shape, and we have all these kind of health buffers around us. But we don't. We have expensive fire engines and equipment, and the work week destroys the person inside the uniform.
I think that, you know, that this is probably the most acute example is in the first responder community. where, like you said, the machines and the technology are where we invest all of our resources. And we treat the humans as kind of a fungible, necessary but fungible, kind of almost disposable. And that actually applies, you know, but I would say that, that putting the machinery on the pedestal applies across every industry. You know, one of my mantras right now is that we as humans need to be at least as measured as our machines. And that's like, I don't think it's an unreasonable ask. And I'll give you a couple examples that I know of. Whenever we engineer a complicated machine, we build in, just like we did at SpaceX, we build in the capability to measure that machine completely in its healthy state. And that's key. We don't bring the sensors to a broken machine and then try to figure out what's broken about it. We build them into the DNA of that machine. As an example, a modern car produces about 25 gigabytes per hour of sensor data. That is four times more total data than a human being will get from the healthcare system in their entire life. So every hour, your Toyota Camry is producing more data than you will get, four times more data than you get in your entire life. And that's not to say, like, I want to be clear, it's not to say that every measurement coming off the Toyota's sensor system is some sort of incredible insight or breakthrough. It's actually the exact opposite. The vast majority of that data is totally mundane. It's not saying anything is bad. It's saying, it's just reporting out that everything is healthy. But as soon as there's a blip, as soon as something changes, your check engine light comes on or your tire pressure gauge comes on. You can intervene before you have a blowout on the highway with your daughter in the back seat and your car rolls, right? We have these intervention mechanisms to avoid catastrophic failure. And it would be absolutely untenable to take those sensor systems out of our cars. The same goes for our jet engines, right? When you're flying, airline travel is by far the safest method of transportation. It's safer than walking. So like walking on a city street is more dangerous than flying in an airplane, which is hard to believe, but it absolutely is the case. You can look at the statistics. And part of the reason for that is that we take safety as an incredibly high priority. Failure is not an option of a jet aircraft with 250 people flying across the Atlantic Ocean. And those machines are measured with tens of thousands of sensors continuously, again, to measure health state so that we know when something goes wrong. And you know, the pilot flying that aircraft feels peace of mind knowing that as soon as something goes wrong with one of those engines or with the airframe, they're going to get an alert because the system is instrumented accordingly. Now, where is that analogous capability in our healthcare? All of us right now, if we're being honest, all of us are flying completely blind. We do not have any such system that is keeping track of where we are, how we're performing, and what is slowly but quietly failing in the background. And so unfortunately, most of us are. We are actually degrading unnecessarily. And that's just across the general population. Now put the first responder in, you know, the environment that you all are in incredibly high stress, fast acting, and oftentimes toxic environments, over and over and over again, there is going to be an accumulation of stress and damage that is going to have an impact on human health. And the fact is that we just simply we have not decided to invest the resources in being able to measure that. And I think that's an absolute travesty. And it's, it's a complete miscarriage of justice in a lot of cases, because it will only show up decades down the line, maybe when that person's already retired, or it will happen on the job, you know, unfortunately and acutely. And I think that happens, you know, we see that way too often. It's avoidable. It requires a rethinking of what is important and where we should place our investments. And it also requires a completely new lens on health care in general, like what healthcare actually means. And I would just posit that, you know, again, we should be at least as measured as our machines. That's my only ask. It's not that big of an ask.
It's funny that you use aviation as an example, because if you look at pilots, you know, they have crew rest. They can only fly for X amount of hours and they've got to sleep for X amount of hours. And I think the 24-hour shift, because we have fire stations, we have beds, we can at least get naps. It's still the best model. Otherwise, you start breaking up the day and now the circadian rhythm is all over the place. But it's putting that rest and recovery between each of those sleepless nights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where, like you said, there's so much emphasis on safety in aviation, and they do have these stringent operating, you know, procedures in fire. I mean, you know, 24 is the minimum that you will work, but, you know, we are seeing a staffing shortage because of mismanagement, because of refusing to change. that now we have first responders working 80. One of my California friends just told me he's on a 120-hour shift at the moment, 5 days straight. So put that guy in a plane. Would you get on? I sure as hell wouldn't. There's no way.
No way. It's unbelievable. Yeah. The, you know, the, we do this in all of our tip of the spear industries. I think, you know, I have a very close friend who's a cardiothoracic surgeon at, you know, in a very, very well-known and top-notch health system. And he was describing a heart, you know, essentially an incredibly emergent heart surgery that he had to do. And it was a 16-hour surgery, and he started at 30 hours into his shift. So he had not closed his eyes for 30 hours, and he was trying to lace up his shoes. I remember this vividly. He was describing, I was tying my shoelaces because I had just, you know, I had just sat down and taken my shoes off to try to get some rest. And then they came in, you know, the call came. He's trying to tie his shoes, and he could not focus enough. His dexterity was so impacted that he was struggling to tie a knot in his shoelace so he could go to the OR. And I just, you know, I have to wonder, like, would the family, it's nothing against him. He's being forced into this situation. He's going to go and try and perform the best that he possibly can. But would the family have the confidence knowing that that was the case, that his dexterity was so impacted? And, you know, it's like the actual skill and capability that our, you know, our best bring to the table is completely diminished, probably lower than the average when we run dry. And we just know this about performance. We know the impacts of sleep, and both in the acute and chronically. And, you know, I think what's even worse is that when you do this long-term, when you make this the standard expectation, you start to experience systemic failure. Like, it's not just that in the moment you're struggling to focus or that you're like a little sluggish. It's that over time, the systems break down. And the number one and two, I believe the number one and two causes of death for firefighters right now are heart attack and occupational cancers. And the correlations between sleep, inflammation, and chronic stress and heart disease are so well understood. It's almost like it's not even worth rehashing. Like, everybody knows that these are so closely linked. In fact, they're so closely linked that this is a really interesting anecdote. Every year when daylight savings happens and we lose an hour of sleep, the number of heart attacks and strokes goes up by 26% on that day. Perhaps it's over that week, but the loss of that sleep, just 1 hour in the general population, is so dramatic that we know, like clockwork, that we are going to lose an extra 25% of people to heart attacks. They may have been lingering. They already had heart disease, but it puts them over the edge. And when we're doing this in literally the occupation for our first responders, we are forcing some number to have an unnecessary heart attack death. And that is unacceptable. Why are we doing this?
There are so many incidents where we've lost firefighters, you know, to a multitude of things, from, you know, falling off the ladder to getting lost in a search. And, you know, we always chalk that down to the job, and no one thinks, well, you know, when did they last sleep? We just had a fire truck, for some reason, make a decision. The barriers were down on a train line. They were on the way to a call, and so they drove around the barriers and got nailed by a train. I don't think that would have been the decision that person would have normally made. I guarantee you sleep deprivation was included in that. And it's funny, because when you were talking about the medical side, I've talked about this a few times on here. The guy that really kind of began the insane surgical residency, you know, we're doing these crazy hours, William Halstead, it was discovered, this was in the 1800s, that he was a cocaine and heroin addict.
Yep.
So even like the, you know, the why do we do this? You look far enough back, there's no reason. But I was on the paramedic clinical once in the OB ward, and this clearly very, very, you know, veteran obstetrician was delivering this baby. And I was in the corner. It was kind of like I just had to observe. That was it. He clamped both sides of the cord, and then he cut the other side of the clamp, the side of the patient. And like a Monty Python sketch, blood just started spurting everywhere. And this man must have clamped and cut thousands of umbilical cords. But I'm sure, because this was, I think it was like early in the morning, he'd probably been on call or been up all night. That was obviously salvageable. You get another clamp and, you know, she didn't lose too much blood and we were good. But if that was an aorta during a cardiac surgery, that patient probably would have died. So this is why, you know, just to underline what you're talking about, it is so, so important. And then you look at the chronic effects of sleep deprivation. The biggest killer of firefighters and cops is actually suicide at the moment. Mm. So there's a direct correlation between sleep deprivation and all things mental health as well. Mm. So like you're talking about with the, you know, the check engine light, that's the physiological side, but also that ties into the psychological side too.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a really fascinating and an increasing body of evidence that's looking at the psychological health as it relates to physiological markers. And there are predictive models that can look at a combination of biomarkers and predict the likelihood of a depressive episode for people who are predisposed. And it's pretty clear that that is going to be a future area of study that is going to become forefront and primary, right? We're going to start being capable of predictive models on the individual level, not again at the population level. I'm most interested in, for me, and for my loved ones, how do we equip them with enough information that there can be that check engine light equivalent for whatever it is that they're most predisposed for or at risk of. And the fascinating thing is that many of these, well, most, I would say, most of these conditions, and I'll say that separately potentially from depression, because there are obviously multi-factors and I don't claim to have all the expertise, but in many, many cases, we're experiencing the compounding effect of lots and lots of lifestyle factors. That's what we're experiencing. It's very rare that some single event occurs that triggers in and of itself a disorder that is life-threatening. It's very often, I think, the compounding effect, and that's our sleep, our stress, what we're eating, the sunlight exposure, our activity levels, and of course, genetic predisposition and other factors. And so, you know, I struggle with our current paradigm where we throw people into the fire, literally, and we do so without even the most cursory inspection to help them understand their own health state and to help us understand the predisposition of these people towards, resilience, right? How resilient is that person to what we're asking of them? We just don't do it. And I really like my mission with Levels is to change how we treat health data, to put the power into the hands of the individual to access, own, and take action on that information, and then to bring in experts to help validate or provide, additional plans, expertise, validation, et cetera. But I think the most important thing is to change the paradigm. The healthcare system should not own my data or tell me what I can access. It should be me who makes that decision. Very comparable to financial data. You know, if you went to a bank and you asked for some like information about your accounts, and some bank employee told you, no, you don't need that. You don't need access to that. You can imagine what would happen next. But for some reason, we're willing to accept that in healthcare. You know, this is information about your individual body, your predisposition to death. And we allow the system to stand between us and that information. And that's got to entirely disappear before anything can change.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about the kind of the nucleus of Levels being the continuous glucose monitoring and then the blood work and the app. What has been the evolution of that over the last 5 years?
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. Yeah. Step one was, I mentioned that I had used the continuous glucose monitor and I was absolutely blown away by the technology. I thought physical fitness is essentially health. And the way that played out is that I would look at the fittest person in the gym or online, the real pinnacle athlete, and I would look at what they were doing with their lives in terms of what they were eating, how they were training, and I would kind of replicate that to the best of my ability. And what that often meant was, I would eat a lot like they did, but I wasn't training like they did, right? So if you're a Tour de France athlete or you're a bodybuilder, you're putting in 4 to 8 hours of work per day. I was putting in 45 minutes. And yet I was carb loading and glycogen replenishing and using all these terms that I thought I understood, just like that person, eating hundreds of grams of carbohydrates and that sort of thing. And when I put a continuous glucose monitor on, I immediately saw that all of those things were way overclocked for my system. They were the portion sizing, the content, the timing, it was all really, really bad. And what I was experiencing was essentially pre-diabetes. My blood sugar was really chaotic. I was experiencing a ton of what's called variability, huge spikes and huge crashes, which are inflammatory. They increase your likelihood of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And straight up, they just affect your quality of life. when your blood sugar is crashing from a really high point, you feel that, or I felt that, as extreme fatigue and really a mood change. And so the CGM, immediately, the power of it is that it's continuously measuring, and you can see within minutes, you eat a thing and you can see how that is affecting your blood sugar. And I was able to do trial and error and really like dial in a dietary lifestyle or approach that dramatically improved those symptoms. So levels was all, now again, at the time I had tried to get a CGM from my doctor and he said flat out, no, you're not diabetic. You don't need this thing. So I actually got one from Australia where they were over the counter and used that. And that, so that was how I had to get it. It was like this gray market thing. But, and so the first thing that I wanted to do with levels was break the barrier down to continuous glucose monitors. So in the very first era, it was all about get more people, regardless of their health state, access to this tool and just make that step one. Once that barrier was overcome, step two was, okay, now take that data that people are collecting and help them actually understand it. Because, you know, it turns out when you put a device on someone's arm, you know, oftentimes they've never seen blood sugar data before and they have no idea what to make of it. And it can be really confusing, right? So we built this software ecosystem that through the Levels app that pulls the data off of a CGM, contextualizes it, so puts it directly alongside the lifestyle choices that are affecting blood sugar, like sleep, nutrition, you know, exercise, stress, and helps people interpret that. So we're doing a lot of AI analysis on it and directly explaining the correlations between actions and reactions. We're now entering phase three with levels. And what we're doing with three is we're moving past just measurement to measurable health improvement. And so that means that we don't just want people to put a CGM on and measure their, you know, and just see correlations. We want to show them how to take a measurement and improve the most priority biomarkers that are directly affecting their health. And to do that, we've expanded beyond just continuous glucose. We've added comprehensive blood work in addition. So we have hundreds of biomarkers that we measure with these blood panels. We combine that with the lifestyle data and the CGM data that you're collecting through levels. And then we identify the highest health priorities and we help you actually improve those markers to reduce your long-term risk.
One of the, I think, the least observed markers, unless you're obviously in a certain group that's very aware of this in the first responder professions, is actually testosterone. And again, you look at the impact of that from sleep deprivation, it just destroys it completely. Have you become aware of that with the groups that you've worked with in this third tier?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The number of hormone irregularities is really shocking. There are many, many, many reasons, I think, why our hormones are being assaulted in our modern era. But what we're seeing consistently is, specifically in men, testosterone is down. So the current modern 20-year-old has the testosterone levels of a 60-year-old 20 years ago. That's the trend that we're on. This is an absolute disaster, obviously. And I think there are a lot of factors. As you said, chronic sleep deprivation destroys hormones. It breaks the circadian rhythms during which the body replenishes and synthesizes. There are rhythms to basically every molecule in our body, and they are synced with our sleep and wake cycles. And so when you blow those up, you are breaking the body's programmed hormone synthesis schedule. Another really fascinating thing is there are studies that show if you give a man 75 grams of sugar, this is called an oral glucose tolerance test. You drink this sugary drink and then you measure blood sugar for the 2 hours after that. So a study showed that during an oral glucose tolerance test, testosterone is also suppressed by about 40 to 50% for the entire duration of that test. So as soon as you drink that sugary beverage, for the next 2 hours, testosterone is cut almost in half. And, you know, the duration of the test is not super long. So I don't have like a ton of long-term data on this, but you can imagine if somebody is let's say that they're poorly slept, they're working a, like you said, 100-hour shift, right? And they're having to get in calories quickly and whenever they can, like around work shifts. Those calories are probably coming in the form of quick processed snacks, you know, granola bars and candy and, you know, and energy drinks with a lot of sugar in them to help us feel replenished. So you can imagine you're both poorly slept and you're spiking your blood sugar consistently and creating this testosterone suppression over and over and over again. So if you, let's say you drink an energy drink, it suppresses your testosterone 40%, and then you drink another one 2 hours later, your testosterone is already suppressed. Now, are we suppressing it again, another 50%? I mean, I don't have the answer to this question, but the data shows that there is obviously a direct connection between these crucial hormones that affect male health and female health and the actions we're taking every day. And we're compounding these things over decades during our work. And we just aren't measuring the impact. So it's no surprise that that hormone therapies like testosterone replacement are through the roof right now. We're sort of, you know, injecting replacements for this stuff, which I'm sure it helps restore quality of life for a lot of people. But I just wonder, how much are we putting a Band-Aid on a problem that we could otherwise fix just through different choices if we knew the data?
This is the argument, one of the arguments for the 42-hour work week that I'm just, you know, the dead horse that I'm flogging with with a whip in each hand at the moment, because that's just it. We've got literally, you know, go to any fire station, you ask, you know, and this is obviously affecting women as well, but testosterone is more of an impact on men, this particular area. But you ask, you know, late 20s, early 30s, who should be just dripping with testosterone. I mean, they are the, you know, the protectors of the community. They have to be fit, so they should be arguably pretty athletic. And they're, you know, 200, you know, 250 maybe. And it's insane. And then, like you said, then they go to a men's clinic, and then the predatory actions of those, they're like, well, here's TRT. Now, you know, I'm a big fan, if you there's nothing you can do about lifestyle changes in the middle, there are peptides. At least you're getting your body to make its own testosterone still. But just like you said, the first step should always be, well, can I sleep more? Can I get some strength training in? What am I eating? Now, I mean, that's the first time I've heard that correlation with glucose. So all these factors that we know can reverse this and get testosterone back up. You know, it's such a, it breaks my heart, because I've got friends that are on TRT and they're on it forever now. That's it. It's affecting their fertility. It's affecting their hair loss. You know, for lack of a better term, the bitch tits. I mean, all the thing, the back knee, these are all real things that come along with TRT. So, you know, when people really start understanding the impact that these shifts are having, and that if they simply went to a healthier work week and got more sleep and were cognizant of their own sleep at home, of course, I mean, it's ownership too, that they could reverse this and get close to normal again without any pharmaceuticals. I mean, that's the message that we're just not hearing. It's all TRT and, you know, optimization, but in the wrong way, a chemical optimization, not lifestyle optimization.
Yeah, 100%. And this is one example of so many, right? Across the board, there are important biomarkers that track and directly demonstrate changes in system health. And we have this total, you know, what I believe to be the root cause is, well, what I believe to be the root cause of the ongoing issue, the reason we don't fix it is because we have a complete scarcity of data. We don't connect our actions to these reactions. And so it's much easier to take a single data point where testosterone comes back at 200 and say, oh, your testosterone's 200, time for TRT. And I would say, well, if we had increased the cadence of measurement so that person was measuring on a quarterly basis, at least for the past 5 years, I think what we would see is a dramatic decline associated with a change in sleep or a change in nutrition or a combination of these factors that, again, if we go to a data abundance approach to healthcare, we would take more measurements and we would say, okay, let's try X and Y, and then we're going to remeasure in a month, and we're going to try Z and A, and we're going to remeasure a month after that. And you're going to turn the knobs and remove the low-hanging fruit. And then we'll find out quite quickly, you know, over the course of a few months. And actually, I know people who have done exactly this. They've had fertility issues correlated with very low testosterone. They went through a series of lifestyle changes with like consistent measurement and completely restored testosterone to healthy levels, like from sub 200 to mid 600s without TRT. And so now you've restored your body's natural function. And from there, if 600 still isn't doing the trick, great. Now we're adding a smaller dose of TRT that's going to have less of a complication for the body that will get you to wherever you need to be. But I think we do this across every single category, from heart disease markers to blood pressure to hormones. We are measuring minimally. We're taking action on too few data points, and we're not in any way trying to address the root causes, which in most cases are completely in our control. And so that's the whole objective with Levels, is to give people the cadence of measurement that you need and the types of measurement that you need to see across the spectrum how your body's performing, and then to show cause and effect and provide lifestyle first programs to improve those things. And it's pretty amazing the things you can accomplish in just 4 weeks. I have a predisposition to heart disease in my family. Apolipoprotein B is this, it's an LDL cholesterol particle that is directly associated. It is the particle that builds up plaques in the arteries. So my ApoB was high, it was at 100. And following our lifestyle program for cardiovascular disease, I brought that from 100 to 73, which is well within the optimal range, in 4 weeks. 30% reduction using just lifestyle. If you look at standard healthcare data, they're going to tell you that that is not possible. Only a medication can cause that. And so this is possible across many, many different types of markers, but you got to measure and you got to connect the dots between action and reaction. So anyway, it's a paradigm shift.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny. First thing that you just made me think of something that I've never thought of before, and I know has never been presented anywhere I've ever worked, but it's just simply doing a baseline full blood work at the front door before, you know, when you start in the fire service, because unless you come from another department, you would have, I'm assuming, be a 9-to-5er, you went to school. So as you begin, you should be at a good baseline. You're still young, you're still healthy. And then, like you said, if you've got quarterly, you know, markers, then you can start to see trending. It doesn't, you know, one time, like you said, doesn't mean you're going to die, but if there's a continuous downward line, then yeah, there's some issues that need to be done. With the lifestyle change, one of the things that I saw with my own eyes, and I always got blood work done from an annual firefighter physical point of view. And again, not always as in depth as we're talking about, but I went plant-based for about 6 months, and about 2 or 3 months into that, I had the annual physical again. And the doctor literally said to me, "Can you tell me how you eat? I've never seen such good blood work in my life." And all I had done is gone plant-based, and I didn't stay plant-based, you know, but if you certainly, like you said, if you've got some markers that are off, I think the plant-based diet, if nothing else, is amazing for recalibrating, get everything down, and then you can start putting meat back if that's what you choose.
Absolutely. It's so incredible how much, and it's not surprising. I think a lot of us, myself included early on, kind of roll our eyes at the nutrition dogma because there's so many competing concepts. And over time, you just kind of think, you know what, it's just calories. Like, what's the difference? Well, the question is not, are calories calories? Because that's a thermodynamics question. It's like, yes, every calorie is the same. It's a unit of energy. What matters is, are macronutrients, are all macronutrients equal? And different nutritional philosophies and makeups like plant-based versus carnivore have completely different macronutrient content. And that has a major impact. So the quantity of fats and proteins and sugars is totally different between them and fiber. And these are bioactive molecules that change the chemistry in your body. And it's incredible how fast you can affect massive numbers of markers. The ApoB change that I was able to achieve, I did that with a lot of animal protein. Typically, you know, you're going to be told that you have to do a plant-based diet, and I've done these before, to bring cardiovascular markers down. But I did lean protein, low saturated fat, and I massively increased fiber. And that directly crashed my ApoB down by 30%. There's a long-term cardiovascular risk reduction right there that is equivalent to taking medication. People would be really surprised, and I think really empowered, if they knew, like you did, how in control you are of these sorts of things. And so, you know, once again, like exactly as you said, what I envision for the future of healthcare, but certainly for high-risk jobs, like this should be the basis, is a baselining when you first start, and then a continual tracking so that we know directly when something starts to go awry. And if overall we're seeing an entire workforce where the veterans are sitting at a very low health state and the new people are on a trajectory to the same spot, we know we're doing something wrong, right? And it's like, there's no covering that up. I think the individuals will want this change, and the infrastructure, the organization will want the change. And we will know, you know, how to address that, because we can connect lifestyle, the specific lifestyle changes, to outcomes in the body.
Absolutely. One other byproduct of the plant-based was I've never had such clean poos in my life. It was like the ghost wipe, as they call it. So that was fiber. A plus for anyone that's got an upset stomach.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, I've had this, you know, conversation. I've had, you know, vegans on the show, and, you know, you hear these, you know, carnivores and they're just, you know, dying on their sword. But again, the middle ground is they're both removing the processed foods. You know, ultimately, that's what it is. So, you know, if you choose to go all carnivore, you know, good for you if that works for your body type. I kind of feel like historically humans have eaten, you know, fruits and vegetables too. So, and then the meat side was probably more of a scavenger than a hunter for a long, long time. But I mean, I think that's why bone broth does well in humans, because we were probably sucking out bone marrow years and years and years ago. So I 100% believe we're omnivores, but you remove that processed crap. And in my case, it was learning I was lactose intolerant after, you know, literally almost 40 years, which is a late adopter. That was it. That was our moment. It was literally overnight. The moment I took dairy out, and I actually put it back in again now because the gut biome is kind of a lot better than it was. But the number of diseases that absolutely are reversible, and I think Forks Over Knives does a great job, even though it is a plant-based kind of leaning documentary. There's all these testimonies of kind of, you know, patients that the other doctors had just given up on that went with this doctor that put them on the plant base. And, you know, they were like, that was 20 years ago and here I am. So, you know, I think it's so empowering, like you said, using the word hope, for people to realize just how much they can control their own health. If sadly, in some cases, they ignore what their doctor tells them.
It's I think that the trend has been, and it's interesting, it calls back all the way to the COVID conversation, where, you know, we've seen this massive reduction in trust. And I think that the average response these days, when I talk to people about their quote unquote healthcare strategy, is, oh, I don't go to the doctor. You know, I don't need that in my life. And I think it's because we've all caught on to the fact that there's a pretty clear lack of personalization. The one size fits all, knee-jerk reflexive 15-minute appointment is just not cutting it. It does not convince us that what is being said is right. And I think that's just like our own, we instinctively develop this intuition about information. Like we're always developing filters for what's right and what's not. And we don't buy it when we're told the same thing that we've done already, or that you know personally just simply doesn't fit with your own experience. And this is why, again, I think that our healthcare system, doctors need to stop being the prevention and treatment arm for chronic illness. Again, chronic illnesses did not exist by and large a few decades ago. And the reason for this is multifactorial, but environmental toxins, the nutrition composition, ultra processed foods, the amount of activity versus sedentary lifestyle, quality of our sleep, light pollution, you name it. There's so many reasons why this is all happening. But the fact is that is, our chronic illness is related to an abundance of different factors than have ever existed in human history. And doctors, the healthcare system is built for trauma. It's built for car accidents. It's built for knee or leg splints when there's a compound fracture. It's built for, you know, incising out a tumor or non-communicable disease treatment. Like all of these things are what every dollar that goes into the healthcare system should be associated with. But instead, 9 out of every $10 is being spent on chronic illness. These things like diabetes and stroke and dementia and heart disease. And that paradigm's broken. We have to stop having doctors be the first line, and we have to start providing products and services directly to individual people so that they can understand that they are the ones turning the knobs and pulling the levers that are affecting their health state. And it's so powerful once you know that, and you know that just the composition of your plate actually does have an incredibly powerful effect on your current and future health. It immediately, I think it just suddenly shuts down a part of the brain that is always on and always freaked out that something is going to quietly sneak up on you. And now all of a sudden, you know, I can measure and I can take action and I can improve these things. It's really exciting in some way. It's frustrating to look at the system as it exists. And I know you feel this way about, you know, the work week and about all of the things that are broken about our first responder industry. I feel this way about the healthcare system, but I also know that the first domino has already fallen and the other dominoes are going to start falling quickly thereafter. As people are starting to catch on to this, the tools are becoming readily accessible and more affordable. And it's just a matter of time until this groundswell turns into the status quo, the new status quo.
An interesting innovation was kind of brought to me about 3 or 4 years ago now, and it was the red tape that was cut, I think, during and after COVID that allowed this to progress more, but the telehealth embedding in 911. So you call, you are a new parent, so you've got, a young child. First time they had a fever, they've thrown up, and you're like, oh my God, you're kind of freaking out, and you call 911. As of now, they send us. They send two paramedics and we come. And, if we're parents, we'll be even more calm and tell them, hey, the fever will be fine. We just got to take them down. Just leave them in a diaper. Do you have Tylenol? Okay, give them the pediatric dose. We can take you to the hospital, but, in all honesty, they're going to be much more comfortable here. And then if that's okay with you, you sign a refusal and off we go. That same exact process can be done through telehealth. So you call 911. And the way this company, GMR, describes it, you've got ALS, which is the true emergency, BLS, which would be, broken leg or something. And then you have non-emergent. So this third tier, and that's the one that would then be siphoned off, if the caller was okay with that, to a nurse, to a physician if you needed it. And they can do everything from set up urgent care clinics, send an Uber to that person, prescribe prescriptions if they do the telehealth with a physician and get that sent from a pharmacy. I mean, so many things that you would historically, call 911 for, either correctly or incorrectly. So it's, again, using this more advanced technology to take the pressure off the first responder profession. And it's cheaper for the patient, a lot cheaper. And now you've freed up an ER bed for, as you said, the real emergencies, the car accidents and the strokes and all the things. So with that being said, we keep hearing about AI, and I'm sure the AI now, as we talk in 2025, 5 years later, is a completely different animal than 2020. So what exciting possibilities are there now for this AI technology to analyze these data points that you're getting from the monitoring and the blood work?
It's unbelievable, the changes in the past 5 years. And I think that the bottom line, the most important thing for all of us to think about, is that AI is a tool. And what I'm most impressed by is the ability for these models to take incredibly complicated, fragmented information and make a clear and consistent pattern recognition out of it. This is something that humans are okay at, but actually we're very prone to biases. So frequency or recency bias. So the more times you see a certain thing, if you're a doctor, the more likely you are to assume that a similar circumstance is that same thing. The more recently that you've seen a certain case, and this has all been studied, the more likely a doctor is to diagnose a new case as that thing they saw most recently. So we're prone to these things. AI, when properly trained with the right data sets, is not prone to those things. It has other issues, but the models that we're going to see emerge in the healthcare world and that Levels is already working with are unbelievably powerful at identifying subtle pattern changes that a human would completely miss and surfacing those as priorities to pay attention to. And this can be, directly correlating like changes in insulin resistance with fertility, which, a lot of people don't connect those dots, like systems level stuff that's very straightforward. It can also be like multiple steps removed where the data is out there in the ecosystem, the AI has been trained on it, but a doctor has never read that paper. And so it knows the correlation between a specific symptom or set of behaviors and the onset of, for example, a cancer. And so what we're able to do is just offload a lot of the raw analysis to these AI tools. So you could, what Levels is building is the ability for, first of all, people who use Levels own and control their entire data set. It's yours. You can export it. You can delete it. It's yours. We never sell it. We never send it to any third parties without your permission. And then we think that that's super critical. Like I've said all through this conversation, people need to have control and empowerment over their data. And one of the most powerful things that we're building the capability for people to do is to add all of their health record data. So all of your labs, all of your body image scans, MRIs, DEXA scans, cardiovascular scans, anything that you've ever developed, you know, that is in combination your health record, to add that into the tool that Levels has built, and then to basically talk to an AI about it, and to get specifically a complete interpretation of that combined health record that tells you the most you'll ever know, or in my experience, the most comprehensive look at my own health state that I've ever seen comes from these models. And they're infinitely patient. They can talk to anyone regardless of your education level and explain to you why you may be experiencing the symptoms you are experiencing, why you may be predisposed to X, Y, or Z, and then what to do about it. And so it's not that it's going to replace doctors. It's that it's going to be able to facilitate a much more informed conversation, both for the doctor and for the patient. And so we have with Levels, like I've said, we've got blood work, CGM. We have these AI tools that do a lot of really powerful interpretation. And then we have clinicians that review and validate the health state information, right? They provide a validated human expert opinion on where your health priorities lie and what you can do about it. And a lot of this is very informed and facilitated by AI models. It's just like they're so seamlessly integrated now through the experience, and they're providing leverage across the experience in this incredible way. And relative to 2019, there's nothing even close. You know, we were using them just to generate very small snippets, and they were not intelligent. They were not, you know, cross-functional. It's really night and day changed. And we have not yet seen the outcome, what it's going to do for human health.
Well, also for comedy, because I've seen AI videos of the Queen rapping in a Jamaican accent, which is my highlight of every day now. So
that too. Yeah, they have some creativity, I guess.
Going back on a serious point, though, with the doctors, because I want to make sure that, you know, that we're underlining the fact that it's not demonizing doctors at all, and that I really empathize with the fact that, you know, the good physicians don't get enough time with the patient. And I was thinking when you were talking, if you or I went to a hospital for a thing, how many hours and days would we be there while they're running all these tests before you can actually say, okay, this is it? And you're expecting someone to come up with that in 15 minutes, someone that maybe walks through a door and is asking for a specific medication as well. So the same way as when you change the work week, change the start time in the fire service, and then put in telehealth, you would free up so much more time for police, fire, EMS, or certainly fire and EMS in my world, to then work on their fitness, work on their training, you know, and be a much better first responder. I think this is going to be an amazing tool to alleviate the pressure on our healthcare system. And I think the NHS, which I talk about all the time, when I was young, the NHS was incredible. Before privatization, before the obesity epidemic hit the UK as well, which breaks my heart when I go home now. But it's no wonder that it's crumbling. It's a great system, but it was allowed to be picked apart financially. And then the Brits got fatter and sicker, to put it bluntly. So if you can reverse that and just reserve that taxpayers' money for childbirths, the elderly, car accidents, cancers, et cetera, just like you said, then there would be plenty of, you know, beds and not doctors and nurses. So it sounds like AI, you know, telehealth, I mean, all these tools that we're seeing coming up now would actually be a blessing for healthcare, a blessing for first responders, so that we actually then can have the rest and recovery to perform at the highest level. And that surgeon, you know, wouldn't be overwhelmed and could come in after a good night's sleep and then perform that surgery.
No doubt in my mind. The AI, I think the AI tools will end up, you'll end up with something like a personal model that takes all of your data and does the absolute best job. It's almost like a digital twin. You might hear this this term often, but does the best possible job of representing your personal health in real time. That will be an AI model of sorts that you'll constantly be interacting with. You'll be providing it with updated information, whether it's new tests or describing, you know, by documenting what you're eating, you know, on a daily basis, or the sleep quality coming off of your wristwatch. It'll constantly be evolving and really be the real-time representation of your health. So that will be in and of itself an AI tool. And the beauty is that it will be able to communicate with you. So what I love about the models, these LLMs that have exploded over the past few years, is that they're such a simple interface to complex stuff, right? You're able to just talk to it in human language. I mean, it's such an incredible, like miraculous almost tech capability to be able to talk to a code base essentially about incredibly complex topics. But you'll be able to communicate with your own health, which is like kind of a weird concept, but very, 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 very much coming soon. And then we will have, at a larger scale, the AI models that will be supporting the health system. Doctors and nurses will have their own, I think their own assistant of sorts that really helps them with their own personal philosophy, right? Everybody's got their own bedside manner. They've got their own experiences. They've got their own skill sets. They'll be supplemented with these incredibly powerful models so that when somebody comes to them, they'll be able to take the digital twin information from that person's health, interpret it through their own model and lens, and then provide real humanized healthcare, right? The human element is what's going to be able to shine, because that doctor isn't trying to cram, you know, interpretation, analysis, and diagnosis into, you know, 15-minute slot. They'll be able to, maybe even remotely, take all that data in, do all of the complicated work through the AI, and then spend most of the time working on a humanized plan to help this person improve as necessary, or an intervention, right? Like going directly to fixing the problem. And so I think that I'm very bullish about this. It's really important that people own the AI health wave. I think that's really important, that it doesn't just, you know, come through the healthcare system. There has to be the personal side of this in order for it to really be as good as it can be. And regulations have to play nice. You know, I would really hate to see a bunch of fear-mongering and like oppressive state-by-state regulation. Today, every state has its own healthcare and medical regulations. So a doctor in New York cannot treat a patient in New Jersey who literally may live 1 mile away. And so that's silly. If we end up with something similar and we like fracture the regulatory environment in similar ways, it's for AI or for these healthcare tools, we're just going to like delay the capability for them to improve our health by, who knows, decades.
We have the same thing in the fire service where there's not reciprocity in a lot of states. And literally you have fire engines with hose and you have trucks with ladders. And yes, there are some idiosyncrasies depending on where you work in the country. But at its core, you know, 90% of what we do is identical. So that's a conversation now as we look at the recruitment crisis, is how many people need to move state, you know, from family or whatever it is. They just want to get out the cold. Take those barriers down because they're literally pointless. You know, of course, do an orientation, an academy for that department. So you learn, you know, the Florida way, the Buffalo way, whatever it is. And then, have a probation to make sure that person is a good employee. But I mean, the fact that we have these barriers up is insane. It really is.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, there's a lot of things that have to change, but the pace feels really high right now. You know, things are changing in the technology world really rapidly. A lot of the technology frustratingly has existed for a very long time. Many of the tests and just raw technology to give people better control of their healthcare has been around for decades. And it's really difficult to comprehend the amount of unnecessary loss of life and quality of life that we've suffered just because those tools have been inaccessible or directly gatekept out of people's hands. Right now I'm really working with my parents to help them get the tests that I know that they need to better understand their cardiovascular health and their metabolic health, because as they get older, you know, it's the risk goes up exponentially. And it's so difficult for them. You know, they're just having to deal with all this coordination and these complicated demands and requirements, and there's faxes and there's emails, and it's just so broken. It's like so bad. The product experience of healthcare is so terrible. And I hope that people start demanding alternatives and whether that's at the political level or at the, at the personal, like at the healthcare system level where you walk in and you just get poor service. I hope that we start finding ways to provide feedback into that system, because it's so depressing. And at the same time, I look on the other side, I look at the technology space and I look at the pace of AI models and at the next generation technologies that are around the corner. And I'm like, there's a space age future of incredible health around the corner. And I don't know how these things are going to, I really can't picture how they're going to merge, because it's like, they're so different, but I'm, I'm optimistic. I'm staying optimistic. So.
Well, going to the actual product then, talk to me about the different levels that you offer as far as the tools that people get for that subscription.
Yeah, so we offer three experiences, we call them. Levels Classic is for the person who wants to really have an open exploration of continuous glucose data. So it's really about getting a CGM sensor and using the Levels app to explore how different actions and reactions occur. So, you know, really just self-exploration with a continuous glucose monitor. And, you know, this is prompted by and with feedback from our app, exploring nutrition, various food types, portion sizes, timing, all that stuff, exercise, impact, sleep, and even stress state. So it's a really nice way to get started and to try this incredible tool. The next is Levels Core, which is our most popular package right now. It's twice per year. You get a 28 marker, a very high value 28 marker blood panel, along with a CGM twice per year. And you do these basically periods of analysis or measurement where you're wearing the CGM, you're logging nutrition, exercise, sleep, all of that gets combined with the blood biomarkers. And then you get one of our licensed clinicians in your state reviews and analyzes all of that data and provides recommendations for how to improve specifically the biomarkers that are of highest priority for you. And so by doing that twice per year, you have a really nice cadence to check in and see the improvements as they've happened. And then Levels Complete goes even deeper. It's a 100 marker panel twice per year. It's the same clinician analysis. There's four CGMs instead of two, so people can wear one per quarter. And you're really getting an incredibly deep profile of your health consistently. And these in-app programs combined with Levels coaches. So our coaches are there with you continuously. You know, some people like lots of interaction with the coaches. Some people like very little. But bottom line, they're there to support your experience. And that's where, you know, through Levels Complete, we get some really incredible results across biomarker improvement because, you know, we've got that extra element of coaching there and the depth of the blood panels. So overall, the packages they're sort of replacing a metabolic health clinic. You know, you pay a lot more and go to one of these concierge clinics and they would give, you know, probably a comparable suite of services. With Levels, it's very convenient. It's all done e-commerce. You can just order online, interact with us all through the internet. And then you get, in addition, the sort of health record I was describing previously and all of the AI tools for interpretation and in-app programs are all built into all of the experiences.
See, what I like about this, I was just actually on the phone to a company that one of the first departments in Florida went to the 42-hour work week, their chief, Hugh Bruder, was telling me, and it's like a full body MRI, and apparently they're catching all kinds of things, which is phenomenal, but that's still, things are already starting to go wrong. The engine light is on, as you said. But what I like about, especially if you're able to do it at the front door with this baseline testing, is, you know, these 6 monthly blood draws, and like you said, CGM, and the analysis is that you can constantly keep tweaking it rather than waiting, you know, 15, 20 years, and now there's a mass in your skull or whatever it is. Well, I'm glad you caught it, but it would have been great not to have got this in the first place. So, you know, those two hand in hand, I think would be phenomenal. You get this full kind of, you know, comprehensive internal ongoing tracking, if you like, with blood work, but then you also get the, okay, let me just do a Xerox of my body and make sure, you know, we're not missing anything. So those two side by side, I think, would be phenomenal. And I know the, you know, the investment per firefighter versus how much it would cost for, you know, chemotherapy, for some sort of surgery, or, you know, a lifetime of drugs. I mean, it would be, you know, so much more cost effective.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's an initiative that we're taking on right now, which is to bring our packages, our comprehensive health tracking and improvement packages to first responder teams. Because I think that once again, you know, it's one of the most acute examples where when we don't pay close attention to the changes and to the current health state, there are dramatic consequences. And so we really want to equip teams to be able to baseline all of their members, especially as somebody new shows up, right? Understanding where their starting point is, and then be that constant background health trend, you know, as life plays out, and to identify ways to keep people healthier. You know, I think that you mentioned MRI, and with the hazards of fire and first responding, cancer and heart disease are towards the top of the list. And you know, there's some really powerful tools just to kind of rattle off the ones that I personally use or know are providing a ton of value. On the cancer side, there are two, I think, really phenomenal tools. There's full body MRI, like you mentioned, where you can get just like a complete Xerox. There's no radiation involved. And they can look for masses through all the soft tissues in your body and just generally look at even like joint health and, you know, some really, really great like blueprinting. But if you do see something in that scan, the beauty is you can look, do another one, right? These are readily accessible tools. And so you can see, is that mass evolving or changing? And so it's a really awesome way of staying up to speed on the soft tissue health. And then there's this tool called a liquid biopsy, which is Grail Gallery test, which is a blood test, but it looks for cancer DNA. It looks for fragments of cancer that could be circulating in the bloodstream because tumors shed, right? And it doesn't necessarily tell you where cancer might be developing, but it's a really powerful tool to look, once again, through a blood test for, I think there's like over 50 types of cancer that are captured with this. So another really awesome early test. And then, you know, I could go on, like on the heart disease side, there's just no replacement for consistent blood work. Heart disease is such a major, it is the number one killer across the United States. Men and women die from heart disease above everything else. And it is a preventable disease for 99% of people. The legs of the stool that most affect heart disease are blood lipids, so cholesterol particles, bad cholesterol particles in the bloodstream, and inflammation. And the combination of those two is an absolutely devastating impact on artery health, and that eventually leads to plaques that build up and then a heart attack. And the things that can drive inflammation are, there's a lot of them, but environmental toxins in particular is a really is a major driver. So we're working with there's a new company kind of in stealth right now that has developed this incredible 300 marker environmental toxin panel that's going to become available quite soon. And we will provide that through Levels Complete. And so that'll be looking at PFAS and, you know, glyphosate and all these environmental toxins that are coming through our systems. That combined with blood testing for cholesterol particles like ApoB, LP little a is another one, lipoprotein A, and inflammatory markers like HSC reactive protein. By looking at all of those consistently, we can see those cholesterol and inflammation markers directly, and we can track them. And then I would also recommend tracking cortisol consistently. And if you're watching these, you know, if they're already high, there are some awesome interventions which we could talk about, but if they're, you know, nice and steady and in range, great, but let's keep watching, because that does not stay the same through life. These things are very dynamic and they can change quite quickly.
Well, you touched on that. So what are some of the interventions that you're most fond of?
Yeah. So I think specifically on the cardiovascular front, this is, you know, my current top priority. So I was able to bring my ApoB down, like I said. So apolipoprotein B, again, it's this particle, it's a cholesterol particle that has this protein on it that makes it very sticky. And it ends up getting lodged in the wall of our arteries. So ApoB is necessary for heart disease to happen, period. It's not, maybe it's not the only reason inflammation has to also seemingly be present for that plaque to start, but without the lipoproteins there, you can't build the plaque. So it's the raw material. So you want to get that as low as possible. And I was able to bring mine down again in just 4 to 6 weeks with lifestyle only by 30%. And the way that I did that was I ate 40 grams per day of fiber. I ate 1 gram per pound of protein every day, which replaced a lot of other things like dietary fats and carbohydrates. Fast-acting carbohydrates, so I avoided ultra-processed foods, which are typically flours and sugars, and that reduces inflammation. So that was my sort of nutrition approach, reduce processed sugars and flours, increase fiber to 40 grams, increase protein to 1 gram per pound of body weight, and then I reduced my saturated fat to 10% of my calories. And this is like, it's a lot easier to track in a tool. I use Levels to track all my macros, but that was the main intervention, was nutrition. Then I took some supplements. So I took fish oil every day. I took a gram of EPA, DHA fish oil, which you can get basically anywhere. And I took a supplement called natokinase. I don't know how much the supplements matter. Fish oil is well documented as being very effective. The natokinase is an enzyme that is found in, it's actually very common in Japan. So a lot of Japanese eat a dish called natto, which is like a fermented chickpea food. And this enzyme develops in there, and it is associated with cardiovascular health. And it actually is shown at high doses to reduce existing plaques in the arteries. So it can actually reduce the volume of blockage in your heart if you already have this. So I started taking that as well. I take that every day. And bottom line, in just 6 weeks, and again, I took no medications on top of this. I didn't change my sleep patterns because I don't have control. My baby does. I didn't change my exercise. Those changes directly dropped my ApoB by 30% in 6 weeks. It's incredibly huge reduction in cardiovascular disease risk for me. And I would just absolutely recommend, such an easy starting point, just a few modifications. I still eat foods I love, very easy. And then, sorry, just to provide one other recommendation, there's a really powerful scan called an arterial calcium score. So it looks at coronary, it looks at your heart, and it looks for calcium in your arteries. And calcium in your arteries is part of the plaque that's growing. You can get this scan for $150. Anyone can get it. I can't recommend enough going and getting that scan done, because especially if you're in, if you're in your 40s to 60s, you're in the highest risk category for the development of plaques. This is an easy, non-invasive scan, and it will tell you if you already have development here, which if you do, you should absolutely pay close attention to the lifestyle factors.
It's interesting that you talk about the diet in Japan for a couple of reasons. I actually lived there for about 15 months in 2001-ish, either side of that. But two things. Firstly, I didn't realize that I think it was a few years before I was there, in the 90s or maybe late 80s, they actually had seen, I'm sure it wasn't anywhere near an obesity crisis, but they'd seen the beginning of a trending in the wrong way when it came to their health. So they actually nationally changed portion size. And if you look at it, a Japanese meal, they are very small portions. And then the other thing is, in the Japanese schools, all the food is made from scratch, not sauces or anything, everything is made from scratch. And that is something that we do so poorly here. Not only is it processed food, but I just learned literally about 2 weeks ago that it's basically out of date processed food that they sell to prisons and schools. So you compare those to Japanese culture, making it from, scratch in the school, to the way that we feed our children, and look at the health of the Japanese children and the American children. I mean, there's a huge room for conversation there as well.
It's always infuriated me, but since having my son, I cannot imagine putting him in a situation at such a young age where I know that the legs of the stool of health that I just addressed are deliberately being chopped off. I can't do that to him at a young age. I know that, again, health outcomes are the compounding effect over years and decades of the daily decisions we take. And if we're pushing our children to consume ultra-processed poisons, which is what they are, if you look at the impact, the inflammatory response, the blood sugar response to eating these foods, it's the same as what happens when you consume a toxin. And our bodies don't recognize them and are not able to process them effectively. It's a complete trap. I mean, I think we're putting our heads in the sand to some extent. Some people are loudly complaining about this, but we've industrialized the production of a product that is not an industrial. It's not an industrial process. Agriculture is intentionally supposed to be a very natural, distributed, local process. Food production should be nearby. It should be in the quantities and from the environment that we live in. And instead, we have centralized plants that are cranking this out furniture or car parts and distributing it all over the world. And they're stripping out all the nutrients to be able to do that. And I think there's something really beautiful, and I think something really wise about the cultures like Japan, who know that just instinctively, they know that it's obvious that is the wrong way to treat food. I think there's so much emotion and so much heart that goes into food production in some of these other countries that are, frankly, more established than us. They've been around longer. For whatever reason, there's this sort of social wisdom that I think has developed, and they've decided not to ship you know, the equivalent of shredded cardboard to their children, pressed into patties with sugar added. They've decided to make it from scratch in the building. And I think that's just really amazing and what we should all strive to see in our own culture. There should be a total, I don't exactly understand why we've rationalized this, because the current adolescent pre-diabetes population is now at 28%. So 28% of our children and in adolescents are pre-diabetic. That was 0% like 20 years ago. Actually, diabetes, one of the fastest growing life-threatening conditions for children and even for babies in a lot of cases is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. That term didn't exist. They had to add the non-alcoholic to the front of fatty liver disease because it used to just be for alcoholics. It's like, it's the thing that happens to your liver when you are consuming a ton of alcohol and your body produces a byproduct that is of triglycerides that just stick to your liver and destroy it. Well, turns out you can generate this by eating processed food, eating a ton of fructose, drinking a bunch of sugary drinks. And we are doing this to our children, and they are developing the same thing that advanced multi-decade alcoholics have near end of life. And it eventually develops into complete systemic breakdown. And these children are going to need liver transplants or they're going to die later in life, you know, if this doesn't change. And I mean, I don't really have much more to say than that. It's like, this is completely outrageous. And there are examples around the world of cultures that are doing this better, who do not have no measurable adolescent chronic illness. It just doesn't exist in their cultures. And we could have the same thing. We just have to make a loud noise and demand a difference. I certainly intend to, you know, I hope that everybody else does, but it can start locally. And then I hope that it eventually grows nationally.
I always made lunch for my son, and don't get me wrong, like sometimes I would come to the school with Chick-fil-A, like, as a, you know, every so often, but usually, you know, we're making him whatever it was, but there'd be fruit. And then again, it was, you know, some of the stuff was more processed. There might be chips or, you know, cookies or something, but you know, there was also fruit and fresh meat and all these kind of things. And the same with the exercise, you know, early on when he was in elementary, there was a thing they did called morning mile, and I would volunteer as a parent, and the kids would just walk or run whatever they felt like before school started, and they had recess. And then, you know, as time went on, all that, you know, you get into middle school and high school, PE basically is non-existent. So then, you know, I was always not pushing him, but just encouraging him in jujitsu. And then he got into running, and now volleyball is this thing, but just exposing him and then living it myself, or being that fit dad and that gym full of other fit parents with other fit kids. But this is the problem, is that I was very fortunate. I grew up on a farm. You know, my father was a vet, so I grew up around medicine as well, like traditional healing medicine. But a lot of parents don't have that because they grew up in this household where it was processed food and inactivity. So, you know, it really angers me, because it's not even a left or a right issue. Like, both of them are responsible over decades. And then you look at the news stations again, they had those tickers, the death tickers during COVID. Well, if they kept those going, we'd be at about, you know, 20 million by now. Because people are dying regardless of that virus, of all these preventable illnesses. And as you said, younger and younger and younger. So, you know, this is what really pisses me off, is that was the conversation the whole time, is like, well, we need to address the things that are killing us, virus or no virus. And the moment we rounded out kind of 2022, people were like, well, I don't want to talk about it anymore. And nothing changed. So circling around to the positive side, this is what's so great about this conversation, is we're educating. Like, the whole point of this podcast, I say, is to get people educated and angry. Exactly. You got to understand why you should be angry. Then you'll become angry. Then you'll force change. And this will be initially for your own health. And then once you kind of figure it out for yourself, then you know, your partner and your children, now they start benefiting from it. Now the whole household understands it, and then it resonates outwards. So I think it's really, really exciting. You know, there should be hope. There should be solutions. So I'm sure people listening want to know, you know, where to find this. So where are the best places to find Levels? And then are there any other places to reach you on social media as well?
Yeah. So levels.com is where you can find the company. There, we have a really, I always try to tell people, like, check out what we do, but then also check out the information we produce, because part of the mission of Levels from the very beginning was to inform people, independent of a product, about metabolic health, which is the foundation of how our cells are producing energy from our environment and our food. And it is necessary. Metabolic health is necessary to have physical health or mental health. So the blog is an incredible resource for this. Like, you know, go deep on it. We also have a YouTube channel, and the whole new level is our podcast with some really fantastic conversations with people who from experts across the health spectrum. So I would always recommend starting there. And then you can find Levels as at Levels on Instagram, X, TikTok. And then myself, my handle is at Joshua's Forest. We could put maybe in the notes, and I sometimes write about stuff on X, but I'm typically not on other social media platforms. And then lastly, I do a newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter on our website. It goes out to our regular mailing list, and just kind of talking about the things that I'm really excited about or thinking a lot about or frustrated by typically in the world of health and in my own health. So it's a nice way to follow along with what I'm thinking about.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much. It really is exciting. This is the whole point of this. I want to drag these problems out into the spotlight, but then also bring the solutions. Not otherwise, it just becomes a bitching session, for lack of a better word. So I want to thank you, for what you're doing with Levels, and then also for coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Well, James, I always love these conversations because they're very urgent and specific about in particular population you care so much about, and I think that we need more of exactly this energy, like get angry and then focus that anger on a specific problem until you break it down and then focus on the next one. And it's just so clear that that's what you are doing. And I'm sure your audience appreciates it. And coming from a family of law enforcement, I also appreciate it. So thanks for what you do and for giving me an opportunity.